Well, I hardly knew anything about the place. I mean, I'm sure that what I had in mind when I wrote that was an event which occurred just before, which was the Voyle massacre. I mean, that obviously catapulted Nepal into the news, and it was an extreme and you know, pretty much a bizarre event. So I'm sure when I wrote that line, that's the crazy thing that I was thinking of.
How much of that of your thoughts had changed within the time frame since you arrived in Nepal and the time you sat down to write your book?
Well, a great deal. I mean, I was fortunate that I didn't really come with any great preconceptions. I mean, there's that line in the book about the Voyle massacre, but apart from that, you know, I knew very little about the country, and so I came with a, you know, it was somewhat a blank slate, as it were. But I'd been living here for many years. I mean, more than five by the time I started writing the book. So I developed, I hope, a fairly kind of sort of robust and nuanced understanding of the place by that stage. And what I'd been most interested in, I mean, I'd been working as a journalist, so it was a lot of my thinking about Nepal was about the politics. I mean, I'm interested in history, but it was on the politics that I'd been working, and the conflict and sort of human rights issues during the war, and the peace process and so on. So that was kind of my you know, my background in the subject.
And so why did you decide to write about Kathmandu and not the whole country?
Well, Kathmandu was where I lived, and especially in fact Patan, which is, you know, a district of Kathmandu really, but was once a separate city. I'm interested in architecture, and I'd studied architecture and sort of cities and things as a student, as a postgraduate student. So the way in which a place, you know, a city evolves and works, and it's the way it's made physically as well as the way it's made socially and historically, seemed to me to be a subject which was quite kind of, you know, an interesting way to frame it, or a way that would I could frame it, which would work as a book. I mean, if you take all of Nepal, you know, it's a much bigger subject, and I think sort of more difficult to fit neatly between two covers. Whereas with a city, you can kind of quite neatly, perhaps. That was
Yeah,
what I hoped.
and the amount of stuff you've covered is pretty amazing, I must say. Some of the time periods that you've highlighted is a big research project on its own. How did you go about that?
Well, I knew quite a lot about the contemporary city when I started, you know, through living here and through my work and all the rest of it. And I mean, I was somewhat aware of the history. To write the book, I really had to go back to a lot of other books, and do a lot of reading. And the whole thing took about 4 years, I guess, reading and writing and doing a few other things at the same time. So yeah, a hell of a lot of reading basically, and meeting whoever I could find who would be able to, you know, talk personally about these things.
The difference in terms of research about Kathmandu and Nepal in general is mostly done by British, French, or someone like that from a Western perspective. How different is your work from their work?
Well, I mean, I've got to see myself in that context partly. I mean, especially in the 19th century, you know, the first sort of writing by outsiders about Nepal was basically by British people, imperial officials, you know, from India who were posted up here. So, I mean, that in a way they are my predecessors, although, you know, I'm not a political official. After them came various waves of foreign researchers, especially after 1950, and I drew on their work a great deal. So yeah, I mean, I do exist in that context, and I have to be alert, obviously. I also you know, tried to the extent possible not to rely too much on these you know, foreign sources. I mean, many of them are very rigorous and informative, but I wanted to sort of you know, to not make it just a book about what foreigners say about Kathmandu. So I got as much both living people talking about their own city in there as I possibly could. One thing which distinguishes my thinking from that of, say, you know, a British colonial official who was here 200 years ago is that I know a great deal, you know, more knowledge is available to me than was to him about this country. The sort of the political context, you know, of my presence compared to basically British imperialism 200 years ago is very different, and I you know, I hope that my mindset is equally different. Although obviously there are traces of that imperial mindset which you find in Westerners and especially diplomats and so on in countries like this. And one of the things I wanted to do in the book is kind of show how the story's been made and how the way in which people understand the place, not just foreigners, but, you know, Kathmanduites and Nepalis themselves, the way in which they think about the city has been kind of embellished and changed and invented and honestly kind of made up to some extent. And this is what we understand, or what the locals of this place understand about the place. That's how that's how it happens. That's how a place gets made. That's kind of what I was trying to write about too.
And so the difference between, let's say, folklore and facts, you know, the stories passed down by generations and the facts, quote unquote, that you see while researching, how much difference did you find in what people thought were the real stories about Kathmandu's history?
There's quite a big gap between the kind of the true history, if you like, as is kind of documented in inscriptions or written materials which were generated in the past, you know, what you can say definitely happened and what most people think. I mean, they're not completely distinct, but for example, the story that the Emperor Ashoka came here and built these four stupas around Patan, there's no contemporary evidence for that at all. I mean, the most, you know, the earliest evidence from that is only about 200 years old. So in other words, sort of 2,000 years after it's supposed to have happened, the first person wrote it down. So it doesn't look like an authentic story, yet everyone believes it. The same thing with the Kirata dynasty, for example. Before the Lichavis existed in Kathmandu, there was supposed to have been this outfit called the Kiratas. There's no contemporary written record for them at all. I mean, they first turn up in Vamshavalis, which are these chronicles, about 1,000 years later. So again, it doesn't really seem... I mean, it's a strong tradition. I mean, who knows? There must have been someone here before the Lichavis, and you can call them what you like. Mm. But the first sort of authentic record of anyone refers to the Lichavis. So this is a kind of a popular fallacy to some extent. I mean, I think you could say, or at least...
And you have talked about in your book as well, the relationship between Hinduism and Buddhism in Kathmandu and the coexistence or the assimilation of two religions. What do you think it is?
The story of the famous festival in Patan, which is called Ratamatindranath, is a good example of this. Of this kind of complex process. I mean, I don't think it's very helpful to say, oh, it's about these guys taking those guys, you know, heritage or whatever. I mean, I wouldn't put it in those terms at all. But it appears that this god from Bungamati, Bungadya, as he's sometimes called, may even predate the Lichavis. So when the Lichavis come along and they record the fact that this worship exists in Bungamati, it's already going on. So this is a very, very old cult, you know, say 2,000 odd years old. Later, as Buddhism becomes more popular, as it was in the Lichavi period in Kathmandu, in the Kathmandu Valley, Bungadya becomes associated with Karuna Maya, a Buddhist deity.
Yep.
In the Mala period, the Mala kings were Hindu, although most of their subjects in Patan were Buddhist. They add this new Hindu identity of Matindranath, associated with the yogi Goraknath. There's layers and layers are added, and it becomes a more and more complicated identity. I mean, Buddhists in Patan still call him either Bungadya or Karuna Maya, whereas the more popular name, especially in English, is Matindranath.
During the Maoist conflict, you do mention, you know, you were meeting the Maoist rebels as well as hanging around with the diplomats, with the military officials. The level of access you got seems to be interesting. But what was your experience during that period, covering the conflict as an outsider, yet living in the country, and then you trying to understand the context of the country, and then what you heard from the Maoists and from the supporters of the military, I guess?
Well, it's always difficult to know whether you really are understanding, right? And you can't be sure, and you have to keep on sort of asking yourself, am I being sort of reasonable here? Have I kind of seen what I think I've seen, or, you know, are there pieces missing? I mean, I think as a journalist anyway, you do get wonderful access. I mean, it gives you a license to turn up more or less anywhere and say, I'm a journalist, what's going on? And mostly people will be quite cooperative, actually, especially in Nepal. I mean, in Britain, everyone hates journalists. In Nepal, it's quite a respected profession, I was kind of surprised to discover when I got here. So, you know, you can kind of, you know, range from sort of rather kind of exalted circles to, you know, to the village. And it's one of the attractions of doing that kind of work.
And another thing you've mentioned is also former King's Ganendra's relationship with the diplomats, including the British and the Americans, who were obviously supplying the military hardware. How much of trust was there, or how much, you know, what was it like?
Well, I don't think there was very much trust between the king himself and the diplomats at all. I mean, after he sacked Sher Bahadur Durbar as prime minister in late 2003, I think the diplomats, the Americans and the British, basically is what I'm talking about, were quite keen to give them the benefit of the doubt. They thought the parties were kind of incompetent and corrupt, and basically it was their fault that the Maoists had been able to get as far as they had up to that point. So and they thought the Maoists must be stopped. This is the period after 9/11, remember? They saw it all through a kind of anti-terrorist lens. So I think they thought, you know, maybe the king coming to the party will help, and they encouraged the parties to cooperate with him, which the parties didn't, because the parties had a much better appreciation of you know, the history of monarchy and democracy in Nepal and what the king was really doing. The diplomats were a bit slow to realize. Just before he launched the sort of the second part of his coup at the beginning of 2005, he personally promised in private the British and American ambassadors that he wouldn't do it. So when he did do it, I think the trust between them was really broken pretty severely. I mean, I think they'd already become a little bit kind of frustrated with him. But when he did that, after saying to them in private that he wouldn't, that kind of broke the trust. Because, I mean, they thought the way to end the war is to get the king and the parties cooperating. At first, they thought that meant the parties had to cooperate with the king. I think by a couple of years later, they were beginning to think that meant the king had to soften up and do more to accommodate the parties. But anyway, they wanted those two on one side, and the Maoists in a, you know, a kind of a weakened position, having to accept the terms that which were being given to them on the other. And what finally happened, of course, is that the parties and the Maoists teamed up against the monarchy. So it didn't really end up in the way that they wanted.
Another thing I want to also ask you is about the Madhesi situation. When you are told that, oh, these people are Indians, say people who look like Indians, you know, the Madhesis, they're Indians. What was your reaction?
Well, that was the kind of way that people described the Madhesis who, you know, come around Patan selling fruit to me when I first came 14 years ago or whatever. And at that time, I think people really weren't at all sort of sensitive or conscious to this idea that Madhesis might be offended by that, or that there was kind of real anger about the status of Madhesis among people in the plains. When it all blew over in 2007 with the first Madhesi Andolan, I think it really took everyone by surprise. I mean, even if there was some appreciation among, you know, more alert people that there was an issue there, even that movement's leaders, I think, were really surprised at the scale that the first Madhesi Andolan achieved. And then, of course, they did very well in the 2008 election, the Madhesi-based parties. And it seemed like this issue had really arrived. Their own leaders blew it, obviously. The Madhesi leaders have not been good leaders for their followers. And the national political parties, the NC and the UML, you know, really haven't been very interested in accommodating the agenda of Madhesi politics. That's obvious, I think, especially by now. It was really distressing for me, I mean, very, very kind of depressing and pessimistic to see the way in which Madhesis weren't accommodated in the 2015 constitution eventually. And then the way that, you know, they protested, those protests were violent, no doubt, but a lot of people were killed. And it was really, you know, over the bodies of these protesters that the constitution was finally promulgated. Then there was the blockade, which was, you know, desperate for the country, did a great deal of damage, and also, I think, kind of muddied the waters, because it all became about India, as you suggested in the question, and it allowed people who didn't want to confront the real domestic issues to kind of ignore them. So that's a huge issue now in Nepal, I think. I mean, it's quiet at the moment. It'll undoubtedly be back. And I think to a great extent, and this is kind of really how I end the book, the future of this country is going to depend a great deal on how well this issue is handled and how far those who run this country are prepared to go to compromise with this section of the population.